Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks, and greetings from the other side of Christmas. That's over and done with. Alleluia. How are we doing, David and Matt?
All right. Yeah, we have there were good bits. Cheese, you know, you've definitely got me onto cheese. I've had lots of that and a few drinks. And no, it's been lovely actually, hanging out with my kids, etc. But please start tennis, please.
Matt, I believe, I don't want to misquote you, but you are starting to miss tennis now. Breaking news.
Yes, I'm worthy of my place on the tennis podcast again.
What was the low point of Christmas that made you suddenly wish tennis was happening again?
Oh, all of it. No, I was reminded of that email sign-off that Mary Carrillo has. The world spins and we hang on. That sort of feels like what the last month has been, really. And yeah. Now I'm ready for some tennis to start again.
Imagine being cool enough to have your own signature email sign off.
Yeah,
Mary
and not be lame.
Is.
I'm sure some really lame people have them and it's really uncool.
Yeah.
It's a tightrope to be walking, but
I'm at peace with not ever being as cool as Mary, so you know, I'll just leave it at that.
We've got part three of Sliding Doors Tennis. We've also got some news to bring you up to date with, which we'll be doing in just a moment. But first, the big news is that David has been challenged by Solly Hull-Simon on Thursday. We record this on Monday. David, you're going to accept the gauntlet that has been thrown down?
Don't think so.
No. Too much cheese and booze.
It's not like you, yeah. David.
Too busy. Got another podcast to record on Thursday, and the kids are still not at school.
You never want to deny a gauntlet.
Yeah,
you'll
I know, but
miss
I beat
gauntlet.
Him. I beat him last time, so you know.
Oh, right.
I don't want to ruin
you
it.
This is your way of preserving your streak.
Yeah,
right.
I'm on an unbeaten run, and I'm just going to enjoy the afterglow for a little while longer.
Definitely the mindset of a champion. Definitely.
So, Simon, if you're listening, that's a no.
Well, Roger Federer has decided to do the same, David. It's right. A no to the Australian Open.
Simon's going to love being put in the same sentence.
Thank you, Solly Hull-Simon, for giving me a lovely segue. Roger Federer announced, but the news came out yesterday via Tony Godsick, his agent, and the Associated Press, that Roger Federer will not be travelling to Australia, will not be playing the Australian Open or any warm-up events, and will return to action after Melbourne, whenever and wherever that might be. Which is obviously hugely disappointing news, not wholly unexpected, unless you're the Australian Open, or certainly the Australian Open PR department, bless them. It's incredibly disappointing nonetheless, and also leaves you with this, and I'm sure it leaves Roger Federer with this as well, slightly inert feeling of the knowledge that we might never see Roger Federer play the Australian Open again. That is a real possibility now.
Or anywhere.
I mean, oh, lovely.
Just to expand on it, if if you went back 6 months and somebody told you that Roger Federer won't play the Australian Open, I think we would probably have said, well, why? He's having all these months off. He's having his two surgeries. He's going to be fine by the Australian Open. It was a surprise to me to hear what he said a few weeks ago, that he was in a race against time. I wasn't expecting that. I was absolutely expecting, once he'd said that, for him not to play the Australian Open this time, no matter what Craig Tiley had said. It always seemed to me that he was just, you know, building towards that and letting us down in instalments a little bit. And, you know, obviously wanting to be respectful to the Australian Open, etc. But he wasn't going to be ready. And he also wasn't, it didn't say this specifically, but he probably isn't that keen on sitting for 2 weeks in quarantine, you know, without his family maybe and all that sort of thing. But the reason I've just said, will he ever play again, is because at that age and with two surgeries to that knee, you just don't know whether it is going to be playable again, really, that part of the body. I hope it will be, and I think it probably will be, but I'm definitely now comfortable to sort of look at it and think, well, it's possible that as much as he is totally focusing his efforts on Wimbledon, the Olympics and the US Open, maybe he might get close, build up that training, and it just not be doable.
Yeah, I think there's two scenarios here. I think there's one that the knee is still a massive question mark, and in that case, yeah, I think the question has to be asked whether we'll ever see him play again, because if it's not fit now after, 10 months, then why would 11 months be enough? Why would 12 months be enough? Scenario two is that the knee is okay, but general fitness wise, he's examined his canister and he sees one summer's worth of tennis in it. And he is choosing to deploy that in a way that maximizes his chances of achieving what remaining realistic goals he has.
And then in an enjoyable setting. Yeah. I'm not trying to diss the Australian Open, but it would be an ordeal. It's going to be an ordeal for everybody, isn't it?
It would, but it's still, even let's say it's scenario two, it's a big gamble for a guy that said he's got no appetite to play without crowds. Because at the moment, and things can change, hopefully not for the worse with the Australian Open, at the moment, the Australian Open is the best and only chance this year of being guaranteed to play in a normal-ish situation with crowds. There are absolutely no guarantees that even if Federer is fully fit for at any stage later this year, he will be able to play what feels like normal tennis and what feels like the kind of tennis that he wants to go out on. So it's a heck of a gamble.
Mm-hmm. To offer a sliver of optimism.
Yes, please.
It doesn't sound to me like he's had another setback.
Mm.
Like, I think the reason he's behind schedule is because of the original setback he had a few months ago.
Is it better to have 1 year-long setback or two 6 month setbacks?
I think he was knocked for six by a setback he had after the original knee surgery, and it's almost like he had to start again. So he's way behind schedule. Mm. We've seen pictures of him hitting tennis balls, which, as I gather, hadn't been happening that much throughout this year. He's finally hitting again. So I think it's possible that he is moving in the right direction with the knee, but I totally agree with you that even if he is moving in that right direction, there are still question marks over his general fitness and certainly the longevity that he's got left in him and whether it is anything longer than just a condensed period next summer. That was meant to be the optimistic note.
Imagine he, what do we think, makes his return for the grass? Stuttgart? Could Stuttgart be the place?
Could be. I mean, the way they're talking and reports, I mean, Tony Godsick was talking about February and looking at the schedule thereafter. And obviously, there are still big question marks. It looks like Indian Wells isn't going to happen. It looks like Miami may not happen. So, and is he really going to bother with the clay? These are all a lot. There are a lot of big question marks in the schedule, but there is Dubai at the end of February, which is where he bases himself a lot of the time. That may be where he decides to play. Maybe somewhere in Europe before it. But yeah, I mean, I can only imagine that the goal is going to be just to concentrate on trying to make sure he's ready during that spell. But what's the best way to be ready for that spell? That's a question mark I don't know the answer to.
Yeah, I do think there's a scenario in which Federer's body is okay, but he doesn't want to come back at a slam in Australia where he can't be with his family. And therefore, he's pushing it back just a few weeks. And as you said, trying to play Dubai, if that goes ahead, or if it's a normal February swing, maybe Rotterdam or something. He doesn't want to push it for a slam as his first event back. I think that's possible that is the case.
Didn't want to risk getting stuck with Benoit Paire as his practice partner, did he? My dad had a go at me for being too harsh on Benoit Paire.
Oh, yeah? What were his grounds?
He just said he seems like an all right chap. And I said, I'm not slagging off his whole character. I'm just suggesting his track record might not make him seemingly the most sort of COVID-safe person to isolate with for 2 weeks. I'm not trashing his whole character. I also got accused, not by any family members, but in an email correspondence recently, of being anti-horse. I'd like to set the record straight on that. I'm definitely not anti-horse. I love horses. I just, you know, in this specific Martina Hingis-related incident, the horse didn't come off Tina, wasn't the hero of the hour. But generally, very much pro-horse.
Eva Maioli thinks she was.
Would Mr. Whittaker have Benoit Paire on the boat?
Oh.
Do ask.
I will ask, but I don't think he should.
Well,
he doesn't tend to like sort of flashy crew members.
Let's leave it to the man himself to make up his own mind.
Okay.
Yes, all right.
He'll be annoyed if I speak beyond my brief again about Benoit Paire. Mm-hmm. So I shan't do that. Otherwise, they very much enjoy. Oh, he also didn't enjoy how much we laughed at your 2010 predictions, David.
I like you.
Really stuck up for you.
Yeah.
Really stuck up for 2010, David Law.
Thank you, Mr. Whittaker.
I don't know where he was at the time, but
I will take those thanks and live off them.
Yeah. So there we go.
Take those kind words.
More optimistic tennis news before we move on to talking about the glorious past. Andy Murray has been awarded a wild card for the Australian Open. No great surprise. He has also accepted a wild card into the Delray Beach Open starting on January the 5th.
I found that interesting, yeah.
Me too. I found that very interesting. I mean, it doesn't surprise me that he's looking for warm-up tennis ahead of Melbourne, looking for as much tennis as possible. It surprises me that it's that tennis. I mean, I thought that Delray Beach Open would kind of be an exclusively American field, pretty much.
Yeah, it really does add interest, doesn't it, for us particularly. And I think for the event itself, what a great coup for them. But I mean, I think, Matt, you said his first match is 1 a.m. our time. I'll be up.
Yeah, they've already announced their order of play. We don't know their full player field, but we do know when Andy Murray's playing, and it's not at a convenient hour.
We don't even know who he's playing, do we? We just know he is playing.
Yes. Right. Yeah, I mean, you can't blame them for milking it, can you? I mean, as you say, massive coup. I mean, the rest of that field could be, let's face it, it could be ropey, couldn't it? I mean, I have no idea about this, but I would presume Andy Murray might be flying by private jet to Florida, and that might make him might make it feel like less of a risk, a slightly safer option than it otherwise might. I've no idea if that's the case, but you know, if I had the option to go by private jet somewhere rather than travel with other people on a plane. That's certainly what I'd be doing. But yeah, I mean, even within the United States, I mean, I know a lot of players do base themselves in Florida, but it's going to be interesting to see who wants to travel into Florida, because they're certainly one of the looser states, COVID restrictions wise, you know, compared to California, for example, which have been incredibly strict pretty much throughout.
The other three big names on their list, all playing players TBA, but all scheduled on Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, back-to-back, Riley Opelka, John Isner and Milos Raonic. And then they've got a Champions exhibition event before it with the Bryan brothers playing and Tommy Haas and people like that.
They've already transitioned into Champions tennis, the Bryan brothers. Wow. Well, with Opelka, Isner and Raonic as a trio, they needed something to sort of aggregate the playing styles off a little bit, didn't they? They needed some Andy Murray in the recipe mix.
Not sure I'll be watching them at 1 o'clock in the morning.
I'll tell you, the way I'm feeling right now, I will be there when Riley Opelka kicks things off on Thursday night. I'm telling you.
David will be cheering him onto court. I've missed you, Riley.
You and me, Riley. We can look almost eye to eye.
And then the gags about David being the tall person correspondent will ensue, and then it'll all be merry.
Maybe I'll get a call for work. I haven't had many of them recently.
I think that's it for tennis news, unless we have any other pairings news, which I don't think we do. It's been a bit thin on the ground. Anyone would think sort of Christmas had been on or something, but we are desperate for news of female pairings. We will accept flimsy gossip at this stage. So
at Tennis Podcast.
We've done two whole sections worth of flimsy gossip. So
frankly, we'll accept just speculation.
Yeah.
So, absolutely desperate for that. And as soon as we have it, we'll bring it to you. But we should. I think we've dwelled too long in the miserable present. I think we should head back to the lovely past. Oh,
it's not that lovely.
Comfort zone. Oh, okay.
Maybe use somebody else's first.
Have I overbuild it? Okay, Matt, what have you got? Uplift us, please.
Okay, I'm going to present to you a little medley of Roger Federer, actually, sliding doors moments.
I love a medley.
Before arriving at one which I will declare the official Roger Federer sliding door moment, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it.
And I think he's interesting because he is the ultimate achiever in tennis, isn't he, Federer? He's won more than any male player in history. And yet, because he's put himself in that winning position so often, he's inevitably lost a lot of big, important matches as well. I think there's a comparison with Jack Nicklaus in golf. It's a fascinating stat about him that he won 18 majors, but he finished runner-up 19 times. So he's kind of a what-if guy because what if he'd won a few of those? He could be so far ahead of everyone else ever and never be caught.
He was runner-up in 19 majors?
Yeah, so he finished second more than he even won. So he's kind of a what-if guy, even though he's the most successful in major golf. And Federer's similar. He's lost the most finals ever, 11, joint with Lendl. And he's lost the second most semifinals ever, just one behind Jimmy Connors. So he's lost a lot of big matches, essentially. But I think there's probably three matches or moments which got away from him more than any others. The first I want to talk about is the 2005 Australian Open, which was slap bang in the middle of Federer's dominance. From 2004 to 2007, he won 11 of the 12 slams on either grass or hard court. And the only one he didn't win was that 2005 Australian Open, when he lost in the semifinals, classic match, to Marat Safin, who went on to win the title. Federer is serving at 6-5 in the fourth set tiebreak. He's 2 sets to 1 up. He has a match point, and he serve and volleys. on second serve, hits a couple of fantastic volleys, although Henman might disagree, but fantastic volleys.
Relatively speaking.
And Safin comes up with an incredible lob, gets it over his head. Federer, I hesitate to use the word sprint back. He sort of slightly ambles back. He has more time.
It's a saunter.
Mm. And he goes for the tweener. He goes for the glory shot, and he misses it. And a little sliding doors moment there is, what if Federer had thrown up a lob? He's still not the favourite to win that rally. Safin would still have likely won it. But it's very possible that Federer could have dug out that point defensively and won it. And that is a match, a moment, a tournament in the prime of his career that kind of got away from Federer, I would say.
He would have been playing Leighton Hewitt in the final and absolutely been the favourite for that. And I think just the mental aspect of losing match point, having hit an unnecessary tweener.
Mm.
I mean, not many people have been in that situation, especially not in such a high stakes version of it. But I mean, that must just be crippling.
He got panned for that tweener attempt. I would say it felt to me like overkill, really. The criticism he got for it, because as you say, I still think no matter what shot he plays at that particular point, he's second favourite in the rally, and he's still at parity in the tiebreak. It's not like it's ended his chance of winning at that point, that momentary. But people really went for him over that, and I never really understood that.
How did Federer respond to being criticised for that? Did he just brush it off?
I can't say I remember completely. My sense is irritation,
right.
At it. It was an incredible match. I commentated on it, and it was just, it had everything you want. As you say, Federer pretty much at his best, but Safin on one of those rare occasions when he also produced his best, because he didn't do it that often.
Mm.
He was either not bothered enough, or he wasn't focused enough, or wasn't fit enough. He obviously had a lot of injuries, but at that point he was being coached by Peter Lundgren himself, and it was the big story was that here was this, we were talking about how Malisse beat Henman with David Folgate in his box shortly afterwards, and I think Lundgren stopped working with Federer at the end of 2003, and that was despite having won Wimbledon and the Tour Finals. And then he stopped working with him. Federer obviously then went on to have that incredible 04 where he won three of the four slams, I think, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And then turns up in 05, but he's with Safin, is Lundgren. And I interviewed Lundgren the day after Federer lost to Safin. And he said, Marat really wants to push Roger now. He wants to see how far he can push him. And that never really happened again. You know, that this was the peak. This was the best it got for him, wasn't it? Very interesting, though. And what about the sliding doors? I mean, I would say that the shot itself, I can't look at that and think that it was the difference maker, but we'll never know.
Mm.
That was the match that earned me the nickname Tennis Cathy in my halls at uni. And it stuck because I was at uni with only a tiny little telly that could just get terrestrial TV. So I'd followed the whole tournament listening on the radio, David, which is a funny thing, because obviously didn't know you then. I was, what would that have been, 2 years prior to meeting you. But I demanded for that match that it be put on in the common room. I stomped my feet and demanded. And I mean, I was obviously right. By the end, it garnered a crowd. By the tweener moment, everyone was hooked. But before that, it earned me the rightful nickname Tennis Cathy. And it's aged well, that nickname.
Really has. Mm. Yeah, I love that. I've also picked the 2006 Rome final, which we watched earlier this year, when Federer has some match points against Nadal on clay quite early in their rivalry. And it's just, you know, like all these things, it's speculation. But I wonder what would have happened if Federer had won that match against Nadal on clay. Would an early win over him on that surface have unlocked something for him in that rivalry? Would he have been able to carry it into Roland Garros? Because we talked about how much Nadal caused Federer problems with his leftiness and just as a matchup. But there was definitely a mental aspect to Nadal's dominance over Federer in those early years, I think. And I think you could speculate that if Federer wins that Rome match, he takes a lot more confidence into their French Open final just a couple of weeks later. And that could have been a bit different for him. Because he had the game at that stage. He was a more complete player than Nadal.
We spent a whole podcast speculating just that, didn't we, earlier this year. Catch it in our archive. You won't catch me saying that very often. But yeah, for Tennis Relived, I think it's worth delving into the archives.
And then the final one of this group of three is a selection of matches which Federer's lost from two match points up against Djokovic. The semi-finals at the US Open in 2010 and 2011, and then last year's Wimbledon final. The 2010-11 ones, the sliding doors, most obviously, if Federer had won those, we would have got Federer and Nadal at the US Open, because Nadal was waiting in the final both times. I think most people, when they think of those matches, they think of Djokovic's slap forehand return onto the line, which is an incredible shot, an incredible moment, because it's greeted with silence and Djokovic sticks his arms up at the crowd and implores them to applaud him for that incredible, incredible shot. Federer called it quite lucky, I think, in his press conference afterwards.
I remember that.
That's very Hingis.
Yes.
It was, actually. It really was. And back then, Roger was much more like that, I think. He was much more
chippy,
of the opinion that really, if I if I play well, you can't do anything about it, really. And if you did do something about it, you were a bit lucky.
Yeah, but I think it's been slightly forgotten, the 2010 US Open, because I would contend that's actually a even more remarkable match point save from Djokovic. A really long rally ensues, and Djokovic saves it with a drive volley forehand from in between the service line and the baseline. It's an incredibly gutsy shot, and he totally pulls it off. But I think of all the matches Federer would want back, all the moments that I've just mentioned there, I think it has to be last year's Wimbledon final. I watched that game again, and he served consecutive aces to bring up the match points. And the first serve he hits on the match point clips the net. Djokovic is leaning the other way. Honestly, if that is an inch, 2 inches higher, it's another ace, and he's won that match. As it happens, he misses a forehand wide on the first one, and then has quite a tentative approach on the second one. And Djokovic, again, so locked in on all these points, hits a kind of perfect forehand passing shot. But that match was, in football terms, it was a six-pointer. You know, if Federer wins that, he's currently five slams ahead of Djokovic rather than only three. And that feels like such a sliding doors moment. And it, again, that's another one which felt a little bit like it in real time. You thought Federer needs to win this here, because if he loses these match points, as I've just laid out, we've been here before. Djokovic can come back from two match points down. There was so much history on the line in that game.
My brother, who's a massive Federer fan, as regular listeners will know, has a theory based on quite a lot of discussion we've had on the podcast, mostly this year, actually. I think we've discussed generally Federer's losing from match point up record relative to Djokovic and Nadal's, and it's obviously a lot worse. Matt's theory is that Federer has always been a bit of a choker, but for a long part of his career, he was so much better than everyone else that it didn't matter. There you go. Do you want to explain the facial expression you did when I said that, David?
I was surprised. Yeah, I was surprised.
It's not a fully finessed theory. I'm just tossing it out there to throw some cats among the pigeons.
Yeah, I don't agree. Go on, Matt.
I don't necessarily either, but it's an interesting discussion point.
I've always felt with Federer that his style of game is not conducive to really high pressure situations, because he's quite high risk. He will go for things, whereas Djokovic and Nadal, to me, have that kind of safety hardwired into their game, and it allows them to kind of play normally when they're in tight situations. I do think Federer overplays a little bit, or slightly rushes, or I don't know, something in those biggest moments.
Isn't that more recent, though?
I'm sure it is more recent, yes.
Sorry, David, but we did comment on that. I don't think he was match point up, but we did comment on that whilst watching that 06 Rome final,
yeah,
didn't we?
Yeah, he overplayed on the forehand,
He overplayed on the forehand, yeah.
I'd love to go back and look at an assembly of his match points won, though. And I would imagine quite a lot of them are won by a service winner or something like that. But then I suppose I'm going to start disproving my own theory here, but how many of those finals that he's won were close?
Yeah, not many.
You know, we were talking about the Safin match, coming off that 04 season, he's just beaten Leighton Hewitt 6-love, 6-7-6, 6-love. You know, two bagels in a final and just destroying people, so he's very loose. I suppose the pattern that I feel like you can always rely on for Federer, if he's serving for a match, he can just race through the game with a few well-directed serves followed by a forehand, you know. But yeah, I mean, the close ones, that's an interesting thing. I'd love to go back and analyze them, but
So we pissed off Nadal fans in the last episode, or in both the last episodes?
No, it's just me.
Just you.
I did that, yeah.
But it's all collective, David. We all shoulder the burden.
Well,
and today we've
lot,
pissed
we
off
sometimes get
Federer
called.
Fans.
You people from the Tennis Podcast have said.
I haven't actually arrived at my definitive sliding doors moment yet, and it is a positive one for Federer fans.
Go for it, Matt.
Because those ones I've mentioned so far, if they've gone the other way, they've all seen him possibly add to 20 slams. To me, they're adding to an already complete career. But the one I think is the definitive sliding doors moment for Federer is a moment which went his way, and it helped to complete his career. And that's the 2009 French Open. Obviously, most obviously, the sliding doors is Nadal losing to Söderling. That's a huge moment in itself. But I think you can think of that tournament and think Söderling beat Nadal and then Federer won the title. It was like that, but it was a bumpy road to get there. And I'm mainly talking about his round four match with Tommy Haas, which I think is a little bit of a lost in time. I don't think this match is talked about enough.
I'm happy to relive it.
In terms of...
David remembers every point. He's just going to live commentate us through it right now.
No, I just want to watch it.
Federer's basically having a shocker. Nadal has gone out. This is his big chance. And he's 2 sets-to-love down against Tommy
Haas.
He's
choking.
He is. And he's serving at 3-4, 30-40. Break point down. Ooh. And he hits an inside-out forehand that lands plumb on the line. If that is a few centimetres further left, Tommy Haas is serving for that match to knock Federer out in straight sets. Federer nails it, holds, breaks in the next game, completely turns the match around. And I just think that's the sliding doors moment, because if Federer doesn't win the French Open, then would he ever have won the French Open? And if he doesn't win it then, how does it impact how he schedules his career for the next decade or so? Does he switch to a bigger racket earlier? I think it throws up all sorts of questions. And if Federer hasn't won the French Open, that changes completely how we think about his legacy and his career compared to Nadal and Djokovic, who have got all four. So that, to me, the ramifications of that moment, that tournament, are so huge. And when it mattered most, Federer did come up with the goods on his forehand in that match.
Yeah, it would have. The most interesting aspect of that for me is how would it have impacted the remainder of his career, which has obviously turned out to be more than a decade and counting. You know, he wouldn't have been able to skip the clay court seasons in order to maximize his chances at other slams. That would have, and that every single Roland Garros growing with every year would have been the dialogue about whether he can finally win that slam and complete the career grand slam. He would have been the almost guy. The entire complexion of the last 10 years of his career would have felt different, assuming he didn't clinch one of the others over that time, which I can't see him doing.
He'd be the odd one out against the other two, wouldn't he?
He wouldn't now be in the conversation for greatest of all time. You couldn't put him ahead of him. Let's say it's only that one slam that we take away from him. Let's say Nadal still loses to Söderling, but Federer loses to Haas. They're both on 19 now, but Federer doesn't have... Sorry, they're both on 20. No. Oh, goodness, I'm falling down on the maths. Nadal would be on 20, Federer on 19, and Federer wouldn't have a career slam. And nobody would be giving him much of a shout of completing it now. I mean, he's not even in the conversation, is he, at that stage? I mean, it's massive.
Who would have won the 2009 French Open?
Well, I think the answer is either Söderling or Del Potro.
Yeah.
Because Federer then had another five-set match, taking out Del Potro in the semis.
We're pissing off Tommy Haas fans now.
No, we're not.
We're pissing off Tommy Haas.
He's all right. He's presumably in Indian Wells having a nice time. I thought you were going to mention the Andy Roddick Wimbledon volley, Matt.
Yes, for sure. Although I've always just considered that more of an Andy Roddick sliding doors moment. But yeah, it's in there. And I think if Federer hadn't won the French Open in 2009, a knock-on effect would he have won Wimbledon just a month later. But for sure, the Andy Roddick volley in that second set tiebreak is another sliding doors moment in Federer's career, yes. But an even bigger one for Roddick.
I love a montage, a medley. I feel like all of that should have been set to some sort of like 80s piece of music. You know, all sort of upbeat 80s films feature a montage of some kind, some sort of time-lapse situation. Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
David, bring us down. What have you got?
Well, I've got a Serena Williams one, which I think there are a lot of choices that we could have had for it, given the seriousness of so many of her injuries. But given the fact that she is still one Grand Slam title behind Margaret Court, there are so many where you could just say, well, if that one had gone differently or that one, you know, she could have broken the record by now. I've gone for 2010. She's just won Wimbledon, successfully defended her title. She's won the Australian Open and Wimbledon in that year, 2010. And she's gone to Germany and played in an exhibition match against Kim Clijsters. And in Serena's words, and we didn't hear these words for quite some time afterwards, we just knew, the only thing that we knew was that she'd injured a foot in Munich, and she was not going to be able to play certain tournaments for a while. It turned out that having gone to Munich, she told the USA Today newspaper that she was in a restaurant and she trod on some glass, initially thought she'd stubbed her toe, but looked down and there was glass all over the floor and blood all over the floor. She needed 18 stitches in her feet. She thereafter missed the US Open, the Australian Open, and the French Open. Clijsters won both the US Open and the Australian Opens that followed. So those are three slams that Serena has just missed, and she's absolutely at her peak at that point. She's late 20s, I think 28 years of age. And it would be two more years before she would win another Grand Slam title. She did return to Wimbledon the next year and lost in the fourth round to Marion Bartoli. But in the interim, earlier on, just before that Wimbledon, as well as the foot injury, she developed the pulmonary embolism, the blood clot, which, from what we are told, could have taken her life. And I think I interviewed her father at Wimbledon that year. And I remember interviewing him on the player lawn that they gather on, all the players and their coaches and entourages. And he said, I thought I was going to lose her. And that was an incredibly powerful moment. And there were tears in his eyes as he said it. But there was a lot of mystery around what had happened in that restaurant and how she'd come to tread on broken glass. And it was never fully explained. I mean, she herself couldn't explain exactly what had happened. She said, I think I must have passed out with all that went on. But, you know, she was in a real state and missed all those Grand Slam titles. And when you think of how dominant she was back then, if she was playing her best and if she was fully fit, she just used to win. It was just a matter of course. I think by then she'd won 13 Grand Slam titles, and it just felt as though she was going to go on and win many more. Now, obviously, she did do that, but given the historical significance of where we are right now, I just wonder, had that not happened, whether anybody would have stopped her at the US Open, the Australian Open that came to follow, and she could already have that record.
It's a bit of a test of how much you believe in the canister theory, I suppose. Did Serena Williams have sort of a finite amount of tennis in her, and those months, that year or so that was sort of taken out of her has been preserved for later in her career?
Mm. And motivation and all those sort of things. Mm. You never really know, do you? And like I say, there were many, you've chosen a number of Roger Federer moments there, Matt. I mean, there have been so many health issues, major knee problems, you know, the blood clots, all the sort of thing. There's so many that could have chosen, but that one always seemed so dramatic at the time, and it was so shrouded in mystery, and she was so by far the biggest star in the sport. Nobody came close.
Yeah, because as you say, whenever Serena missed the slam, that was an opportunity gone, because she was the favourite for every single slam she entered at the time. And it kind of carried on, didn't it? I know she reached... Didn't she reach the 2011 US Open final? Was that the one she lost to Stoza? But that was very much ahead of schedule, really. She wasn't in any sort of form or expected, really, to do that well. But then at the start of 2012, the Australian Open, again, she was still out of form. That was the one where she lost to Makarova.
As Azarenka was winning those two titles. And, I mean, that was another thought that occurred to me. Would Victoria Azarenka ever have won a Grand Slam had Serena Williams not stepped on the broken glass? You know, I mean, maybe that's doing her a disservice. Maybe she's just good enough. And she was really good back then. But still, it does make me think, wonder on that.
But then it also makes me wonder about whether she needed, whether it was time away or a slump of some sort to then kickstart the rest of her career, where she then hired Patrick Mouratoglou, and she must have won over 10 slams in her 30s, I think. You know, from that 2012 Wimbledon onwards, she then had probably the most successful run of her career for a few years, maybe other than when she won the Serena Slam. But would that have happened if she hadn't had that slump in 2010-11 caused by those injuries? We don't know, but certainly what we do know is that she missed an opportunity for a few years there to add to her Grand Slam tally.
And there's also the what if, not an injury or a bad thing at all, there's also the what if she hadn't had Olympia at the stage that she won her last Grand Slam, Australian Open 2017, that glorious slam. She was, of course, 2 months pregnant at the time with Olympia. She plays Venus in the final. Venus is one of the only people on the planet that knows she's pregnant at the time. This is a little preview into the inevitable Australian Open 2017 relived that we're going to be doing. And she was imperious at that time, Serena. That was the last time, really, with the benefit of hindsight, that she has been completely imperious. And she would have been favourite to go on and win one or two further slams that year and seal the deal on the record. She'd likely have gone and done it that year. You know, if she'd just had Olympia a year later, you know, would she have come back from having Olympia? Because she'd already have probably achieved. You know, this is sort of sliding doors upon sliding doors upon sliding doors. But I guess with a career as lengthy as hers, and this applies to Federer clearly, as we've just heard, there are going to be so many sliding doors moments, but it's fascinating, isn't it? It's absolutely fascinating. And of course, the ultimate one that we're not talking about, because it's sort of too soon, because we're still in it and we don't know all the things to speculate about, but it's the pandemic, isn't it? The pandemic is going to be the ultimate sliding doors moment. And we kind of need to see what ends up happening with Roger Federer and with Serena Williams in particular, maybe even with Nadal, before we even know what direction to take the speculation in. You know, if we never see Roger Federer play again, that will be sort of, the pandemic will end up being the ultimate Roger Federer sliding doors, won't it? But we knocked it around, didn't we, whether to do the pandemic. But it's just so big and so soon. Can you analyse a trauma when you're still in it? Therapists, write in and tell us, please, at Tennis Podcast.
I mean, there's certainly some short-term pandemic-related sliding doors that we could speculate on. For example, Djokovic not winning another slam this year feels very pandemic-caused. Halep maybe not winning a slam. She was in incredible form. But I guess what I'm most interested in with the pandemic is how it changes tennis for the long term. Not even player related, but will tournaments disappear? How different will the calendar look? Will the sort of relationship between players and fans change? Kind of the same questions we have about how the pandemic will change life in general. But it wouldn't surprise me if tennis looked quite different in a few years' time, and that we could point to the pandemic as the moment that things changed.
Hmm. My as I say, I was very tempted to submit the pandemic as my final offering for Sliding Doors Tennis, and maybe when we come back to this in a few years' time, we will. But in fact, and maybe this is slightly inspired by the little puppy that is currently asleep on my lap, very very dutifully in podcasting mode. But my final submission is, what if Billie Jean King hadn't won the Battle of the Sexes in 1973? What if she'd lost that match to Bobby Riggs? Just to kind of remind you of the highlights. Yes, she'd already done a lot of campaigning, done a lot for furthering the cause of women's tennis, women's sport before the Battle of the Sexes in 1973. I mean, it's a massive understatement to say that she had done a lot. She campaigned for, well, actually, it was in September 1970 that, of course, we had the formation of the Women's Tennis Tour, that famous photo with the original nine holding up the $1 bills. They risked everything to do that. They were told by the US LTA that they wouldn't be able to play the US Open and Wimbledon if they did that. Of course, that is something that is being celebrated this year, the 50th anniversary of that happening. And then 2 years after that, the culmination of something that Billie Jean King spent a long time campaigning for, which was Title IX. This was sort of her first foray into real politics. Title IX was passed into law in 1972, and it stated that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation and be denied the benefits of or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. And this was massive. You know, there's countless statistics about the impact this has had over the last 48 years, but as of 2013, the number of female college athletes had grown 622% since Title IX came into force. And in 1972, women earned just 7% of law degrees and 9% of all medical degrees, and it's now more than 50-50. Certainly for medical degrees, and it's 50-50 for law degrees. Then at Wimbledon in 1973, so this is still before the Battle of the Sexes, the WTA was founded, and of course Billie Jean King led the charge for that. But interestingly, just before that, in May of 1973, that's when Margaret Court agrees to play Bobby Riggs. And this is often forgotten. I mean, people that have seen the documentary or the Emma Stone film will probably know about this, but it wasn't something I was aware of before watching all of that. Bobby Riggs beats Margaret Court in 57 minutes, 6-2, 6-1, and it became known as the Mother's Day Massacre because that match took place on US Mother's Day. And Margaret Court had been clear before that match, I am not carrying the banner for women's lib. She said, I am not representing women and the women's movement in this match, which lessened the wider impact of it slightly. And it was after that loss that Billie Jean King agreed to play Bobby Riggs. And she took on representing women and the women's movement in a way that Margaret Court was completely unprepared to. I mean, Margaret Court openly railed against equal prize money. She was absolutely not a figurehead for the women's movement at all. So after Margaret Court's defeat, she agreed to play Bobby Riggs, and the whole hoopla is whipped up. Really stoked by Bobby Riggs. He starts wearing T-shirts saying male chauvinist pig on them. He gives birth to the acronym WORMS, which stands for World Organization for the Retention of Male Supremacy. He told reporters at the time that he was playing in defense of young men who he claimed were being enslaved by women. He said, guys are getting married pretty soon. They won't be able to get out once a week for a poker game, won't be able to go away for a weekend on duck hunting trips. So I don't care about myself, but we've got to stop these women right now. And, you know, he wasn't alone. He wasn't alone in saying that. Stan Smith, who was the Wimbledon champion in 1972. So, you know, his profile is high at this time. And he's not seeking publicity in the same way that Bobby Riggs was with all this stuff. He said, quote, "A woman should stay home and have babies. That's what she's for. I mean, this women's lib thing could go too far." And those quotes from both those two, they remind me of the, obviously they're stronger and they're dated, but they remind me of a lot of the rhetoric that I've heard from, you know, from a lot of men that would probably think of themselves as quite liberated in the past couple of years since Me Too, and since sort of the big fifth wave feminism hoopla, if you want to call it, which is the kind of I'm all for equality and I'm all for the women's movement, but it's gone a bit far. Men can't even chat women up anymore without being accused of rape or sexual harassment or something. That kind of, let's just calm down, women, and not take it too far. You know, reading those comments that were made at the time, they echo of that to me. And then just to kind of carry the sliding doors thing a bit further, apparently the night before what is still the most watched match in tennis history, 100 million viewers tuned in for the Battle of the Sexes. That is, I believe, still a record. The night before the match, Billie Jean calls her brother Randy, and Randy asked her if she was going to win. And Randy was, he liked to dabble in betting. And Billie Jean replied, "Go ahead and bet the house," which is extraordinary to me. You know, Margaret Court, her great rival, had lost to him 2-1 in 57 minutes just months before. And Billie Jean King has a whole lot more riding on this than Margaret Court did, because she is embraced the fact that she is playing for women everywhere, that she is playing for the whole women's movement, that she's playing for women's rights to be treated as human beings. So on 20th September, she plays that match. There are men everywhere in the audience wearing pictures with pigs on them saying "proud male chauvinist pig." Women are there with banners supporting Billie Jean. Billie Jean King is brought into the stadium on the shoulders of male athletes, while Bobby Riggs was brought in by female models that he called his bosom buddies. They exchanged gifts. Bobby Riggs gave her a lollipop, which she presented, and she presented him with a piglet wearing a little pink bow, which I absolutely love. And she embraced the fact that, regardless of how successful she'd been, whatever else she did, she would be remembered for this match for the rest of her life. She took on that pressure. And in an interview in 2017 with Vogue, she said, "With the Battle of the Sexes, we were fighting for our lives. We were only in our third year of professional women's tennis. So I thought that if I lost that match, we'd probably lose everything. And a lot of other people thought that as well. I mean, women couldn't even get a credit card on their own in 1973. She won in straight sets. It was one of the greatest spectacles of the women's liberation movement, featuring a woman who had always tried to argue much more for subtle equality This is also from that Vogue article. She said, "You can see in my with my interviews back in those days, I was walking this tightrope not to alienate." And that I find really interesting from Sliding Doors' perspective as well. This match in this moment helped Billie Jean King find her voice and find her way to be a campaigner. You know, yes, she'd done a lot before then, but that tightrope was really evident. You know, she didn't want to call herself a feminist because she knew how many people that would alienate. She knew that men set the parameters for discussion, and she had to play within those parameters. You know, the very fact that she had to engage in the battle of the sexes. I mean, we know it's irrelevant whether she can beat some has-been. It doesn't matter whether Serena Williams could beat Roger Federer. That's neither here nor there. And she knew that, but she knew the world didn't care. She knew that those were the parameters of the debate at the time, and she had to lower herself to engage with them because women didn't have the power or the luxury to set those parameters themselves. So it solidified her as a campaigner and as a symbol, and it solidified, I think, her comfort in that role. You know, she says herself, "I hadn't really found my voice yet back then. And I had to speak differently in those times." She said, "I had to think, how can I keep people involved in this important conversation?" And it was all about adapting her message for her audience. And I mean, that's such a lesson that I've learned from her. I mean, David will probably roll his eyes and say, "I don't see this in evidence very much." But, you know, having to lower yourself to have certain debates, I just think, oh, I mean, for goodness sake, this is like debating with a child about whether Santa Claus exists. Like, why should I be having to explain to you why I'm not a lesser human being? That annoys me. And the grace with which she has done that throughout her whole career. You know, one of the things in the... This is just turning to me ranting about Billie Jean King with the dog that I've named after her sat on my lap. But you can't stop me now. In the words of a New York Times editorial, I'll just finish on this. Billie Jean King was able in a single tennis match to do more for the cause of women than most feminists can achieve in a lifetime.
Mm. My son, before we started recording today, was asking what we were going to be talking about. And we were talking about Sliding Doors. And I said, my son's 9 years of age. I said, we're going to be talking, one of the subjects will be the Battle of the Sexes. What if Billie Jean King had not won the Battle of the Sexes? And he said to me, if she hadn't, would there be women's tennis?
Mm.
And, you know, I mean, that sounds incredibly dramatic, doesn't it? But it does make you think, really, that in terms of it mattering, or in terms of it being taken seriously, in terms of it being what it is, which is the most powerful women's sport in the world, the best example of equality within sport, then yeah, may well not be. Fascinating.
I certainly don't think it would, and look, hey, there's a long way to go, but I certainly don't think it would be as progressed as it is now. I think I think of the words of Chris Clary saying what a head start tennis has on other sports. This head start that Billie Jean King gave to tennis, and, you know, going off on a tangent, how that's squandered in some quarters or not treated as preciously as it ought to be, and so much of that head start was because of the result of that match. And it oughtn't to have been, of course. Everybody should have looked at it and gone, well, why does this matter? But they didn't. It did matter to people.
Mm. What I've always found interesting and also frustrating about the very phrase Battle of the Sexes is that it doesn't seem to me like it was, because in a battle, both sides have something to lose. Well, the men had nothing to lose in that. It was a completely pressureless match for Bobby Riggs. You know, he lost. Men's tennis didn't suffer at all. Yet if Billie Jean King had lost, women's tennis, women's rights, women's sport would have suffered massively. And I found that really interesting what you said about Billie Jean having to even lower herself to take part in that occasion, which now we would think of as ridiculous and not necessary. And that's kind of the point, because I think by recognizing that it was required to shift public opinion at the time, she took the fight for equality in women's rights, and mainly in women's sport, to the boardroom, to the politics. And it can be tedious and frustrating, the politics of it. And sometimes we lament the lack of big, grand moments like the Battle of the Sexes for women's rights now. We don't get that now. And sometimes that can feel a bit frustrating that people are not using their voice enough, perhaps. But the fact is, now the battle is in the boardrooms, and that's where the change happens. It can be slow and it can be tedious, but it's important that it's there now. And it wasn't there when Billie Jean King had to do the Battle of the Sexes. She took it there. And all the progress that's been made since, and there's a lot more still to make, but at least the conversations are happening now, and they're happening in the right places. And Billie Jean King is massively responsible for that, I think.
It also gave her the confidence and the platform to kind of move on and campaign for LGBT rights as well, which is kind of what she's focused on latterly, just as much as gender-based campaigning. You know, had she lost that, as ridiculous as this sounds, and it shouldn't have been the case, but, you know, would she have been given the credibility and the platform to campaign on other things as well? You know, very possibly not. So perhaps all of that progress wouldn't have been made as well. And I think about those men in the t-shirts with bearing the words "proud male chauvinist pig." And of course those men didn't leave the Houston Aerodrome that day going, "Oh, I'm not a male chauvinist pig anymore." But maybe they were shouting it less proudly. And that matters. You know, I think a lot about, you know, what's happened in our country, in the States, in a lot of places in the world over the past few years. And are there more racists than there were 5 years ago? Has Donald Trump created racists? And I maybe he has a few, but I tend to fall down on thinking, no, he's just made people feel comfortable in their existing prejudices and existing small-mindedness that in a previous world they felt like they had to repress because it wouldn't be well received. You know, you couldn't just sort of rock up at a dinner party and shout racial slurs because that might not go down so well. Whereas I feel like there's a comfort in people's prejudices these days, and there's a validation in them. You can spout them and it will be treated, you know, it will be treated as, you know, everyone's entitled to an opinion, that sort of thing. And yeah, had she lost that day, maybe that comfort in people's small-minded opinions would have perpetuated, and who knows how long for. But I think that maybe those male chauvinists were just a bit less proud about it after that day, and that mattered. And it still matters. And I hate to think where we'd be. I mean, not here.
Also, I think those that perhaps hadn't found their voices yet felt empowered.
Yeah.
That's something that struck me in the last year, and Billie Jean King has referenced Naomi Osaka and Coco Gauff in the way that they have helped it become okay to speak out. Now is the time, she keeps saying. Now is the time to make a stand. You can. And I think that whilst you're not going to change everybody's mind by that moment, that win in the tennis match, a lot of people, their attention would have been drawn to white matters and why they need to do something about it or think differently or give voice to what they're feeling down inside.
Mm. And just finally to pick up on what Matt said about how the stakes weren't, was so far from equal. I mean, there weren't any stakes for Bobby Riggs. He said before the match that if he lost, he would throw himself off a bridge in California. And can you imagine if Billie Jean King had said something like that and then lost? How often that would be quoted, how well known that line would be. And I don't think many people know that Bobby Riggs had said that. And
no, I didn't know that.
Not many people were then asking Bobby Riggs, hey, why aren't you throwing yourself off a bridge in California, mate?
Mm. Sounds like he said a lot of things.
He liked to say things.
Just looking up, he was 55, and that was the worst thing about this whole, well, not the worst, but it was one of the things that added strength to it, is the sheer disrespect being dealt out by beating Margaret Court, you know, a guy who is past it, just trying his absolute best to rub it in, just to try and pull the wool over people's eyes.
It was grotesque, and Billie Jean King would have found it grotesque. All those photos she had to pose for to promote it, and she did it, and she embraced it because she saw the bigger picture, she saw what she could do, and that is... I mean, I couldn't do that. I couldn't stomach it. David's internally nodding here. it blows my mind. But thank goodness she did. Because what would my dog be called if she hadn't? She'd probably be called something really rubbish, like, and I'm not going to finish that sentence because I've already offended people with slagging off horse names. Nobody with a horse called Siobhan has written to us and slagged me off yet, but who knows. So there we have it. Sliding doors tennis, the worlds that could have been, and the promise of a pandemic-themed sliding doors tennis at some point in the future, post-pandemic. Let's not speculate about when that might be, because we don't want to end on a downer. But it's been fun, hasn't it?
Yeah, loads of fun. Well, the sheer fact that we thought we were going to do one episode and we ended up doing three.
Hey, this is our 150th episode, isn't it?
Nope, 151.
Nope. Did we do
We've
that?
We've celebrated 150.
Catherine, we always do the one afterwards, so, you know, you can have your glory. It's fine. 151st episode.
I thought that was a personal celebration between us. I forgot that we'd done it with the listeners as well. Oh, 151, what an achievement. Great, well done us. We are plunging headlong into number 152 in a matter of days, and that will be a two-parter about aggro.
Oh, yeah. I've been waiting nearly 800 episodes for this.
Yes, it's an aggro special. A two-part aggro special. Tennis's best ever aggro. Numbers 1 to 9 will be David Law and Catherine Whittaker.
That could happen.
I don't know whether it'll be a countdown. Do we want to limit ourselves to 10?
We've got some days to decide this.
Yeah. There'll be a lot of it. We'll hit all the aggro notes. Don't you worry. There's plenty of aggro to choose from. I'm sure I can generate some between now and Thursday if there isn't.
Yeah. In which case, there might not be a podcast.
I can generate aggro in an empty room. Just give David a call. That's for Thursday, episode 152. And it'll be... No, it won't be our final one of... Will it be our final one of... When is the new year?
It's the final day of the year.
Is it? It's Thursday, New Year's Eve?
Yes, Catherine.
Yeah.
Oh, and then it'll all be over.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Thank God.
I am going to wake up on the 1st of January and everything will just be fine, right? It's going to be a JR, it's all a dream thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Except there will be a puppy asleep on my shoulder.
I don't think Matt knows who JR is. Do you, Matt?
No.
No. It's actually Bobby Ewing from
is
Dallas.
It? Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never watched it.
It was an 80s phenomena, Matt. And yes, Bobby Ewing, we had an entire series about his sad passing. And then,
okay, yes, I'm aware of this.
Yeah, in the last episode, after the actor had agreed to come back to the show, they needed to find a way to get him back in because their ratings had dipped. And so suddenly, Pam walked into the shower, Bobby's wife, and there he was. And she had had a dream. And it turns out the whole series in which he'd not been alive had been her dream. So there we are.
It's iconic. It's like Fonzie jumping the shark, isn't it? It's become a byword for plot device, for
what's the phrase
jumping the shark?
Yeah, but I don't really know what it means.
To jump the shark. Do you know this, Matt?
No, go on.
Oh, to jump the shark is a... In fact, the Urban Dictionary can probably tell you this, David. Would you like an opportunity to go on the Urban Dictionary? No, you'd just like me to tell you. The Urban Dictionary says thus, it's the beginning of the end. Something is said to have jumped the shark when it has reached its peak and begun a downhill slide to mediocrity or oblivion. It's said to have been coined by John Hayne? Who has a website, jumptheshark.com, and now a book detailing examples, especially as applied to TV shows. It supposedly refers to an episode of the TV show Happy Days, in which Fonzie jumps over a shark on water skis, which Hayne believes was the point at which the series had lost its touch and was beginning to grasp at straws.
Sounds like this podcast.
So nobody's, I believe, listening. There's quite a famous episode of the X-Files when keen listeners believe that shark was jumped.
Yeah.
But
people will be pointing to this moment in this show.
Yeah.
As the moment it jumped.
They won't
the shark.
Know, David, because they've switched off.
True. Which in itself.
So on
everything.
That note, we hope you've enjoyed. And as discussed, we'll be back one last time in 2020 on Thursday with Tennis's Best Ever Aggro Part 1. Thanks once again to everybody that has backed us in our Kickstarter for next year. It's trundling along. It is a continual source of overwhelmment for all of us. If you'd like to get yourself an intro or a shout out, or take us on in predictions, you can do all of those things. Just go to our Kickstarter page. The details are in our show notes. And thank you once again to everybody that has helped us fund this show for 2021, which cannot be worse than 2020.
What, the show?
There you go. I've jinxed it. Join us for one last 2020 pod on Thursday. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.